Hello everyone and welcome to Negotiating Ideas, a podcast about political thought on democracy, pluralism, state and peace in Afghanistan and around the world. I'm your host Omar Sadr. In this episode, I talk to Dr. Mujib Rahimi, who is a prominent writer, political analyst, translator and politician. He's a PhD graduate of University of Essex and author of State Formation in Afghanistan, a Theoretical and Political History, published in 2017 by IB Turris. I wrote a review on the book in Persian in 2018, which was published in a paper Ashtasop in Kabul. Recently, Persian version of the book is published in Kabul. The book presents a discursive critique of the colonial and ethnocentric basis of a state formation in Afghanistan. On the first anniversary of the fall of the Republic in Afghanistan, I thought it would be great to discuss the book with the author. Dr. Rahimi, welcome to Negotiating Ideas.
Thank you for having me in your prestigious and valuable program.
You're welcome. So let me start by asking you the question, if you could give us an overview of the book. What is this book all about?
This book is a critical review, a critical intervention on the discourse of history in Afghanistan. How the power from 1980, when the Afghan post-colonial state was formed after the advance of British Empire and Russian Empire in the region, how Afghanistan emerged as a buffer state under Amir Abdurrahman Khan. And from 1880 to 2010, how the state, different states, of course, with variations, attempted to construct the history of Afghanistan, the history of its emergence, past, and how and when the state emerged in Afghanistan. I discuss this in different periods of time, and at the same time, I look into the power-knowledge relation, the colonial impact, and how the state attempted to monopolize the discursive sphere and marginalize the opposing discourses and hegemonize an ethnocentric discourse of its emergence based on Pashtun nationalism. And at the same time, I cover the dislocation period in Afghanistan, which begins in 1978 after the communist coup d'etat in Afghanistan and the resistance against the coup d'etat and the migration of the Afghan people to different countries, including Iran, Pakistan, and the Western countries. And how the dominant narrative was challenged. And at the same time, I highlight the limits and the negative impact of that dominant state-based discourse of state formation in Afghanistan and try to open the space for possibilities of looking into more democratic and inclusive options for the history and for the history of state in Afghanistan, how we can accommodate the diversity of society and represent that diversity in the state symbols and also in the democratic process.
Well, perfect. So as a political scientist, I think we understand the state in different ways. Some understand it as an institution, some as an organization. IR scholar look at state as a territorial unit. What is interesting about your book is that you use discourse analysis, and in that you try to unpack how discursively state was formed, starting from colonial literature in 18th-19th century onwards towards the 20th century, when you unpack and analyze the official state literature or state-produced documents to understand the colonial nature of state. So I want to also ask you, what do you mean by the fact that the state of Afghanistan is a colonial construction. So if I quote you, you say Afghanistan and its nation state is not an ancient and historical, as it is argued in official discourse, but it's a product of its colonial conditions. It's not a product of socioeconomic or cultural or intellectual traditions. And you're right on that. I just want you to unpack what do you mean by this colonial discourse.
The state you rightly pointed out in your question and introduction that it has different meanings from different looking into it from different disciplines and perspectives. Here, I'm not dealing with the state as it is discussed in political science or international relations, but I do engage with that in the theoretical framework. I have discussed the notion of state, how it emerged, and also the notion of or the concept of post-colonial state. My understanding in the case of Afghanistan is that we had a different political language, a different political setup in the region. By the region here, I mean the Iranian sphere, which is a common civilizational sphere in our region, which includes today's Afghanistan, Central Asian Republics, part of China, and parts of Pakistan. This is the historical Iran. So here, different families, different rulers emerged and governed the region. So their political setup somehow differed from each other and in the ancient time and also during the Muslim times, the Mongol time. So when we're talking of the nation state, this is a new concept which emerged in Europe and it was expanded or exported to the world through the colonialism, or in some cases in Asia and Africa, it was copied by nation states after the colonial experience. In the case of Afghanistan, once a buffer state was created, it was forcefully integrated into the international system. So we're facing in this period post-colonial state in the case of Afghanistan.
This is what some of the scholars distinguish as quasi-state. So one shall distinguish between a sociological definition or concept of the state and the legal, juridical concept of state, right?
Yes, you are absolutely right. That is the case. So the state as it emerged at the beginning, so they try to gradually and slowly to construct a narrative of itself, how it emerged. At the beginning, it was not very organized, but in different stages, it developed. So the state claims that this state of Afghanistan existed for 5,000, in some cases for 10,000 years. It has an ancient history. It was in the region, in the achievements and history of the region, belongs to Afghans because the Afghans existed here for such a long time. So I test this claim of the Afghan state in the literature it has produced about its emergence and existence, whether it is that ancient that as it claims, or it is a new phenomenon and it emerged in it is post-colonial format. So to do so, I follow the double reading. I have discussed that in my theoretical chapter, double reading of the reader and also the deconstruction method, and at the same time, theoretical tools used by Michel Foucault. I construct the narrative of the emergence of state based on the literature produced by the state from 1980 to 2010. And then in the second move, I try to go back to the history of region and also to the dislocation era literature to challenge the official narrative and see if it is standing the test or not.
So on this official narrative, let me go back to your main thesis in the book. You state that the official discourse of Hizb formation in Afghanistan is constituted around a master signifier, which according to you are the two terms or concepts, Afghanistan and Afghan as an identity, and three main nodal points on which this master signifier is constituted, and those are the myth of formation, an emergence of Afghanistan. Second, the notion of jirgas and assemblies as a governance tool. And lastly, the idea of invasion and resistance. So Afghanistan is constituted around these three concepts. Would you elaborate on that?
Thank you. You rightly summarized the main theme of the book. In discourse theory, when you try to analyze or understand a meta-narrative, it could be a story, a history of a state, or any discourse, when you study it in details, you find that the narrative or the story of that, say, in this case, the emergence of state in Afghanistan, has some main points. We call it the master signifier. And then some other noodle points. The master signifier, it chains or brings the whole story together and hold it together and give it a meaning. And the noodle points, of course, in the subdivision, helps the narrative to be more cohesive and organized around the master signifier. Once I studied the history of Afghanistan, as it was portrayed by the official literature, I found out that there are few main points which holds the whole story together. The first thing was Afghanistan and then Afghans. Of course, the second important thing was the Islam, the religion of Islam, and it is very particular understanding and interpretation in Afghanistan or by the Afghan state, which is quite dominant. But in my research, I could not cover that part because it was making my research bigger than a PhD. And my PhD, I have mentioned that Islam is also a main player in Afghanistan, especially the Hanafi school of Islam or understanding of Islam. So if you put that aside, then Afghanistan and Afghans, then the very story of the emergence or re-emergence of the state under the leadership of Ahmad Shah Abdali in 1747, the concept of Luye Jirga, and also the notion of invasion and resistance, these are the main themes in the official historiography of Afghanistan. I discovered that they were put together at different stages. I mean, I have highlighted the gaps, paradoxes, and also tensions in the story. And my unpacking or deconstruction, in very details, I tell how, when the master signifier emerged and then how it developed. And then the nodal points, they were not put together in one stage. So they started patchy and not in a very good shape, but gradually and slowly over time, it reached a level of sophistication at the time of King Zahir Shah. The Afghan means Pashtun. Afghanistan means the land of Pashtuns, which is exclusionary. It does not represent the diversity of Afghanistan. Then the state decided to portray the Pashtun as Pashtuns, give them the name of the Pashtun, and the rest of the ethnicities in the land as Afghans, and try to impose this upon the people, of course, without their consent. Then the whole story is constructed around this Afghanistan and Afghanness. But the state tries to portray the concept of Jirga as an old tradition in Afghanistan. It means Afghanistan was a democratic society ruled by assemblies. And the first king who rebuild the modern Afghanistan. He used this Jirga, this Democratic Assembly in Kandahar. There was 9 days of democratic deliberation, and then through a religious person, Pir Sabir Shah, he was selected as the next leader of Afghanistan while he was silent and not talking. And that story is very dominant in the historical narrative of Afghanistan. That's why in the under the Republic, you see that emphasis on Jirga, Louis Jirga, constitutional Louis Jirga, and sometimes consultative Louis Jirga. And at the same time, the concept of invasion and resistance, the official narrative says the state of Afghanistan existed for thousands of years. Foreigners invaded Afghanistan, the people resisted, they reclaimed their independence. Sometimes there was breakdowns, but they reclaimed that independence again. I found out that during my research that the master signifier of the discourse and the nodal point of Louis Jirga and the emergence was problematized to some extent in the dislocation period. But the concept of invasion and resistance is sadly very dominant still in the memory of Afghans. It's not been challenged by academics or not being dislocated as it stands right now.
On the official discourse of state formation, something struck me when I read the second chapter, and that was the way you reconstruct in a linear manner the trajectory of official discourse of state formation. What do I mean by linear manner? In a way that you have a starting point and then the discourse progresses stage by stage, first from codification, and then it goes to establishment, enrichment, sophistication, and advancement, right? So this is linear. You have a starting point, and then the progress comes, and then there's an end point. The question is, why discourses should follow a linear procedure or trajectory? Don't you think that there could be multiple discourses coexistence at the same time also? And the fact that the discourses who were challenging the mainstream colonial state-sponsored discourse, of course, it also coexisted at the same time along with, side by side, the official discourse, right? So that's number one. Also, apart from that, I was also wondering why every single stage of the state, the official discourse of a state formation that you have been conceptualizing is somehow conflating with a particular historical era, again in a linear manner, starting from 1880s. For example, the codification stage conflates with the early Abdurrahman Khan era. The second stage, which is establishment, that conflates with Habib and Amanullah. The third stage, which is sophistication, of course, understandably, as you go linear, it somehow conflates with Nader Shah, Zahir Shah, and Daud. So again, linearity is not only exclusively with your five stages of the official discourse, but also the way that you redesign or re-narrate history of Afghanistan. How is that?
You are right. That classification or creating a schema is just to enable us to understand different periods of the discourse formation clearly. It could have been otherwise. It is not a must that we should follow that linear line. When I studied the discourse formation, the official discourse of state formation in Afghanistan, I found out that it had a period of codification and establishment. So the codification is the very beginning steps, and the establishment is a little bit developed stage of that period. That codification begins by Amir Abdurrahman Khan, and the establishment by Habibullah Khan's son, where he establishes schools, and Mahmud Tarzi returns to Afghanistan. Then we have newspapers, writings, and some teachers from the subcontinent and from Turkey. So in the later stage, which is the second stage, I call it the establishment and enrichment, that begins from 1919 to 1928 under King Amanullah Khan. We see a lot of developments, a new constitution, new ideas are presented, and at the same time they are working on the languages of Afghanistan. Pashto becomes a little bit prominent, and copying the Turkish model of nationalism, to some extent the European model, and trying to create the discourse of state formation, and new history books are written, but that lays the foundation of this movement. In the third stage, I find out that from 1933 to 1978, the government is focusing a lot on this project. King Nader Shah allocates an office next to his office at the office of the Prime Minister, Sadarati Uzma, to some of the scholars, and tasked them to write the history of Afghanistan and work on the discourse of how the state was emerged and so on and so forth. And the last stage, when I reached to the, I call it dislocation and diversification, here, once we have the communist coup d'etat in Afghanistan and the period of migration and resistance against the Soviet invasion and resistance against the Soviet invasion, different ethnicities of Afghanistan then writing their histories and questioning who we are, where is Afghanistan, how it was formed. So it is the beginning of this location, and it develops. Under the Republic, I found contestation between the forces who emerged from the dislocation period and the Pashtun diaspora who returned by the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan. They wanted to return to back, to return to the era of King Zahir Shah, and consider the rupture, the breakdown in Afghanistan as a period of chaos, and portray it as a chaos, say, okay, we had a republic, everything, a republic and also a kingdom, everything was peaceful, then the Russian invaded, these ethnic groups, they took arm and they created instability in Afghanistan. If you go back to that era, stability will return to Afghanistan. And they were considering the Taliban as a threat of Pashtuns because of their marginalization. And they were successful to some extent in their efforts, and why we had the constitution of King Zahir Shah reinstated in Afghanistan. They only changed the name of the king to president. But the other forces, the Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Hazaras, and some Pashtuns, they were calling for a redefinition of Afghanistan, a new contract, a social contract for Afghanistan, a more democratic, inclusive, and forward-looking one. So this schema, it might ignore some parts. It might not be very inclusive, but it's an attempt to present a clarification for me as a researcher and also for my readers.
I would love to go back to every single stage and probably unpack some of those. The very first one, which is codification, this is the stage wherein Afghan nationalism is not formulated yet, right? Afghan nationalism comes later on during Amir Habib in early 20th century. After formation of Afghan nationalism, it's of course the state utilizes nationalism how to enforce this discourse. What was the tools of a state in the pre-Afghan nationalism stage, which is codification, in order to formulate or enforce this discourse?
During Abdurrahman Khan, he was able to form an army. Of course, he was supported by British Empire. The bureaucracy in Afghanistan took form, the judiciary. At the same time, he published a number of books. There is a book on the history of Afghanistan, he commissioned somebody in the UK to write that book in English. When I read the English version of it, it is very modern. It does not represent Afghanistan, but the book claims that it was written by Amir Abdurrahman Khan. Tajuk Tawarikh. Then it was translated to Farsi under the name of Tajuk Tawarikh in two volumes. So in that book, you see the codification. He says, because he's coming from the Durrani tribe, he says, okay, Hamid Ahmad Shah Abdali is the founder of this dynasty, and he was elected by the people, he was a constitutional monarch, and so on and so forth. So you see a lot in that book about how the Afghan emerged and developed. And also in his other books, which are mainly dealing with the religious narrative or religious construction from the or religious discourse construction from the state, he focuses on the position of the amir or the king in the society, the obedience of the people, the concept of jihad and paying zakat and tax to the king, and especially there are maps you might have seen that he portrays Afghanistan as a hub of Islam threatened by Britain and the Russians from two sides, and he's a defender of this country. You see that move. It's a very, at the first stages, as you rightly pointed out. But then at the time of Hassan, those efforts are intensified, and we see that they decide to write a history on Afghanistan. We have Sarajat Tawarikh.
But what I am struck with is that under codification era, we don't see the three nodal points. We do not see myth of emergence. We do not see the assemblies or jirgas, rule of jirgas, and as a foundation of the state, but also the myth of invasion and resistance. Did you find any of these three nodal points in that era?
No. They do not exist, no. They come in the later stages.
In later stages, right. Further, when it comes to dislocation, you are marking the communist revolution as the start of dislocation, wherein the power shifts towards the Persian-speaker Tajiks, also discourse of policies of the state, becomes much more multicultural, accommodative, and so on and so forth. Now, to me, how do you consider rule of other institutions in 1950s, the starting 50s and 60s, much more before communist revolution? For example, Afghanistan Safarar Revolutionary Organization, which is in Farsi called SAZA. Figures like Tahir Badakhshi, Majid Kalakoni, and those who in 1960s under that democracy, parliamentary democracy, they encountered the ethnocentric colonial narrative of the state. Why shall we consider communist revolution and not these guys?
I do agree with you that nothing begins from a vibe. There must be a background for any movement. The constitutional movement in Afghanistan, the rule of those educated elites who returned back to Afghanistan, and the openness under the decade of democracy, and at the same time, the imprisonment and the punishment those forward-looking progressive people met at that time. All of them, they have played the rule which led to this radical dislocation by the communist coup d'etat in Afghanistan. At the same time, those who you refer to, like Tahir Badakhshi, Majid Kalakani, and others, they are questioning some of the basic or fundamental principles of the state, mainly ruled by Pashtuns at that time, but they do not present an alternative when it comes to the historical narrative of how on Afghanistan and it is nodal points, and is it power knowledge relations based, is constructed by the state. They're mainly focusing on the ethnic hierarchical relations dominant in Afghanistan. The major shift by the communist revolution is that the power goes to Ghilji's, and the Ghilji Pashtuns become dominant, and also Tajiks and Uzbeks and Hazaras become part of the state. Here, they try to construct a prominent rule for Ghilzai Pashtuns. Then we see the rule of Ahmad Shah Abdali is the father of nation, is a prominent figure until then. Then we find a prominent rule for Mirwais Khan as a Ghilzai figure who formed the first state in Afghanistan prior to Ahmad Shah Abdali. They try to accommodate both of them, and Ahmad Shah is called Baba, and he is called Nika, and which again means Baba in Farsi. So, and for the first time under the communist regime, you see a lot of changes in the details of the historical narrative of state formation in Afghanistan. For the first time, they call the atrocities of Amir Abdurrahman Khan against Hazaras as an atrocity, and they condemn him for that. And for the first time, they open the space for other ethnicities to talk about their history, language, and culture. Hazaras are recognized, they become part of the state. And at the same time, the resistance movement, when they migrate to Iran and Pakistan, they start their own publications. And you see a movement challenging the history of Afghanistan and some of the rulers. That lays the foundation for further developments in the years to come.
Okay. So now, as we are speaking on the first anniversary of the fall of Republic, the last stage of discourse formation, of state formation in Afghanistan, you call it the return to the past, which is between 2001 and 2010. What was happening during the Republic? If I can also ask you to elaborate beyond 2010, probably till 2020, how the contestation over national identity, national narrative, nationalism itself happened in Afghanistan. Was the dislocation project or diversification project successful in countering that exclusionary discourse of early 20th century or not?
The equation for the contestation and the discourse theory has two formats. One is this radical antagonism, which is based on constructing as in others, and as the insiders have every right, the other as an enemy. So the equation is based on as the insiders and the others as the enemy should be eliminated and marginalized. And the second equation is as an insider, of course, and the other as our legitimate adversary and opposition. We play under a constitutional regime or a social contract, respecting each other's right while contesting legitimately with each other on social, culture, and all aspects of the society. Under the Republic, majority of those who were in power under King Zahir Shah, and then later under President Dawood, and some under the communist regime, they returned back to Afghanistan. They were living as Afghan diasporas outside, and I think it was hard for them to understand the changes Afghanistan faced in the last 35 years. When they returned back...
You mean those who are continuing the legacy of that...
Returning to the past.
Returning, yes, to the past.
When they returned to Afghanistan, they tried to reinforce and support it with all means. I mean, they used all ideological tools available to the government to reinforce the Pashtun-centric nationalism, which was constructed under the King Zahir Shah and Musahiban dynasty. And they considered also the dislocation period as a chaos and wanted to return back to the Pashtun rule. So their claim was that, okay, if we return to the past and accept and just overcome the dislocation period, it will lead to stability in Afghanistan. So with President Karzai and at the same time President Ghani, they supported that one-sided ethnocentric ideology constructed by the former states. In the constitution of Afghanistan, they brought terms, we have to respect the national terminologies. That led to a lot of contestation between Persian speakers and Pashto speakers. Farsi was not allowed to be used as a name in some of universities, departments. They were only insisting that it should have a Pashto name. So the Afghaniyat, as they call it.
You're referring to the national terminologies.
Yes, the national anthem was also chosen one-sidedly. So at this period, the Afghanness, or they call it Afghaniyat, and then Islamiyat were quite dominant. So they were using Islam as an umbrella, but their main focus was on how to reinforce or protect that the master signifier of the official narrative, which is Afghanistan and Afghanness, and opposing anyone going to other direction, especially the post-location discourses challenging the official narrative. The contestation was very tense, and it continued for the whole duration of the Republic.
So do you consider that dislocation or diversification discourse failed somehow? I mean, you, apart from the formal ethnocentric discourse and the colonial one, you also identify two other discourses. One is that what you call inclusionary discourse of the Tajiks, Hazaras, Uzbeks, and also the last one that you try to make a sentence between all of these three. So based on the explanation that you gave earlier, my understanding is that you assume that the dislocation discourse of the non-Pashtuns somehow failed.
In discourse theory, we believe in hegemonic crisis. Hegemonic crisis means once a discourse is failed to hegemonize the sphere of the contestation. Of course, all discourses, they attempt to reach a level of hegemony using all the tools available to them and marginalize or the other contesting discourses. What I believe is that the state-constructed official discourse is radically dislocated and it is failed and cannot represent the newly changed Afghanistan or the citizens of the country who have gone through a radical change in the last 45 years. At the same time, the contesting discourses, the discourse of Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Hazaras, as you rightly referred to, they were formulated in direct contestation with the official discourse, challenging it. And the relations between the two was that based on that equation of friend and enemy. Hence, my understanding was that the Afghanistan was going through a hegemonic crisis under the Republic. And none of these discourses were hegemonic or acceptable to the majority of the country. And that is why I proposed that this discourse of civilizational discourse with the nodal point or master signifier of a common civilizational sphere with some important nodal points to lead to ease that tension of otherness. And I, after the changes, when, of course, after the Taliban overtook and the Republic collapsed, I believe that still that hegemonic crisis continues. And Taliban and their discourses, of course, with the shift to Islam and then to Afghaniyat, does not represent the Afghan society or the changed Afghanistan.
So do you consider the fall of Republic as a, because of that, the crisis that you mentioned, the hegemonic crisis of these discourses, because they could not sort out their, this crisis was not sorted out somehow by either mean peaceful manner or one of them dominating the other? I mean, what, how do you see the fall of Republic? Midst of this crisis, which you explained?
Of course, that contestation, that radical contestation, the failure of Afghan elite to compromise and find a common ground was one of the main causes, the causes of the failure. The Pashtuns, diaspora, who returned to Afghanistan, they failed to win the leadership battle with the traditional Pashtuns in Afghanistan. To fill that gap, all the time they used to use the ethnic card in politics in Afghanistan. That further complicated the situation. But there, of course, there are some other elements why this liberal project failed in Afghanistan to succeed after a huge investment in blood and treasure in the last 20 years. To my understanding, I mean, one could divide those causes and elements which led to the fall of the Republic or the liberal project into, three categories, internal, regional, and international, which is, this is a cliche, but I mean, it can help to understand why the breakdown took place and the Taliban return back to power. Internally, I think culture and social backwardness need to be considered as an issue because this liberal project in Afghanistan was imposed from top to bottom after an international intervention in the country. So imposing democracy, liberal values from the top, while the society is culturally and economically not ready, it is a problematic, and you have a lot of literature on that in political science and international relations. And thirdly, we were practicing democracy in the absence of Democrats in Afghanistan, those who were leading the change in the democratic process in Afghanistan. They were not believing in democratic values and principles. We have seen that in the rivalry in elections between politicians in Afghanistan, changing sides and ignoring the rule of the game, the democratic rule of game in Afghanistan. Conflict also played an important role, the continuation of the conflict between Taliban and other radical groups with the Afghan state, radicalism, the foreign troops presence in Afghanistan, and the, of course, several countries with it was hard between all of these players to unite their policies, and they had, of course, their own tensions sometime. Elite rivalry, I refer to that, it is an important thing between elites of different ethnic groups, and at the same time, within the ethnic groups, that rivalry was very tense and compromising the fragility of the situation in Afghanistan. And last but not the least, the widespread corruption in Afghanistan, in the state structure and also in the society. Regionally, I think Pakistan, Iran, and Central Asian republics, China and Russia, 11 Gulf states were not in favor of the success of a liberal project in Afghanistan or democratic project in Afghanistan. All of them, they were not supporting in favor of terrorism and radical groups, and at the same time, they were not in favor of the success of the project. So it was in a hostile situation, and it was very hard for it to succeed. They were not in favor of seeing U.S. and Europe succeeding in Afghanistan with this project, which would have gone against all the established rules in the region. Of course, India and Pakistan rivalry played a major role in the failure, especially Pakistan policy of supporting Taliban providing sanctuaries, training, and logistical support for all terrorist groups who are operating inside Afghanistan.
All right.
And internationally, if I summarize it, it was a sudden decision by international community after 9/11, and they came to Afghanistan without, of course, a proper plan, and there was no consistency in their policy in Afghanistan and a well-designed approach. They changed direction from state building and nation building and fighting terrorism then to fighting insurgency and not caring about nation building, state building, and democratic values, and then talking to terrorists and finally handing Afghanistan or abandoning it to terrorists, and also abandoning the policy of so-called principled approach to Afghanistan and cutting a deal with a terrorist group and leaving a nation suffering under this deal, and also supporting a wrong group of ethno-nationalist Afghans, Afghan diasporas who lived mainly in Western countries, especially in the United States. They knew that they were on the wrong side of history in Afghanistan. They were not pursuing the right policies, but still they were ignored and supported by our Western allies. And last but not least was this Kabul-centric approach in neglecting the rule of Afghanistan. And it's a long long story, but these are some of the main factors along that rivalries we talked about.
Sure. So if I ask a last question, at this moment, Afghanistan, apart from all other various forms of crisis, is also facing a deep political crisis as the Taliban, as a very conservative fundamentalist militant group, has won militarily, and but they have somehow sunk the state into crisis because Afghanistan lacks legitimacy. The state lacks legitimacy. It doesn't have also a functioning state. So if I go based on your thesis, that is the failure of the mainstream discourse of state formation. What would be your solution based on your thesis? How can we fix this political crisis in Afghanistan?
I would go for a twofold idea. One is what I have proposed in my thesis as a civilizational discourse, which bridges the gap between these contesting discourses in Afghanistan. One is very exclusionary, denies the rights existence in history of major ethnic groups in Afghanistan. And at the same time, these challenging discourses, which also considers the Pashtun as their enemy and look at them as who usually, or of course, prevent them from fulfilling their dreams, joy, and reaching their goals. So to bridge that gap, I have proposed this idea that, okay, we belong to a common civilizational sphere. The state has to abandon that claim of monopoly over the history, achievement, and whatever has happened in this wider region. For example, in the case of Afghanistan, we believe that Afghanistan existed for 10,000 of years, and all the scholars, rulers, emperors who lived in this common civilizational sphere belong to Afghanistan. And we deny the right of our neighbors, Central Asian Republics, Iran, Pakistan, to those achievements. Regionally, I propose this idea of common civilizational sphere, that anything happened between before the emergence of the post-colonial nation states, that belongs to the region, and we should have a common approach to that and consider it as our common heritage. Internally, we have to accept diversity. I mean, as you have studied that in your PhD yourself, the cultural diversity within the nation state and respected the rights of the people and reconsider the social contract of which emerged under the influence of ethno-nationalism in Afghanistan or in similar cases, and work on a new meta-narrative or social contract, which is more inclusive, democratic, liberal, forward-looking, recognizes the equality of men and women, and it is a progressive one. The second approach, of course, after the changes which took place quite recently, is the internationally. We are asking the international community and those who supported Afghanistan to stick with their principled position against the Taliban. A radical terrorist group has overtaken a country, and the investment of international community and the efforts of a nation has gone in vain, and the country is facing numerous challenges. I am sure that the discourse of the Taliban is, as it is exclusionary narrative, very rigid. It will fail. It does not. It cannot represent Afghanistan. It has reached a deadlock, and they will not be in a position to govern the country or provide services or provide an alternative for Afghanistan. So internationally, our colleagues in liberal world need to have a principled position on Afghanistan, stick with the position as they were present in Afghanistan for the last 20 years, do not recognize the terrorist group, exercise more pressure, and try to enable the Afghan people, the men and women of the country, to achieve their dream of a liberal, progressive, and democratic society. Internally, of course, we have to unite. We have to undertake this struggle and continue our efforts to challenge the Taliban and present our alternative.
Okay, so the last thing that I can ask is if you can recommend one or two readings or books for the audience.
Of course, I would happily recommend your works. The new young generation of Afghanistan who speak English, understand the Western and the academia, and at the same time, they understand deeply Afghanistan. They speak the language of the country. So their work provides more insight, and at the same time, it's hard to choose. I would recommend a couple of books, but I would refer to the Ancient Supremacy, Bukhara, Afghanistan, and the Battle for Balkh from 1731 to 1901 by Jonathan Lee, especially the introduction, The Making of Modern Afghanistan by Hopkins, and some writings of Hanafi, and also the introduction of Syed Asghar Mousavi on the book of Hazaras of Afghanistan and Historical, Cultural, Economic, and Political Study.
Thank you so much. I'm really grateful of your time for appearing here on this show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me in your program.
I will also request at the end the audience to purchase a copy of your book, State Formation and Afghanistan, a Theoretical and Political History. I have really enjoyed this conversation. If you also enjoyed the conversation, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and make sure to share it with your friends on social media. Thanks for listening. We're looking forward to speaking with you on the next session.